Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We have lots for you this hour. Our lighthearted TV tournament continues, and we hear from the people. You have upended our whole competition. We actually like that. Later in the hour, a debate about democracy and money. Where does the voice of the people stand in light of yesterday's Supreme Court decision, McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission? But we want to take you directly into the soul-searching and painful aftermath of the shooting yesterday at Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas. A shooter takes aim at people on base. The base is locked down. After a bloody standoff, the shooter kills himself.
There are reports that he self-reported a traumatic brain injury previously coming back from the Iraq
tour. Any sort of medications?
He was on medications, that's correct.
A moment and a possibly telling detail from one of yesterday's briefings at Fort Hood. Here's President Obama speaking about the sense of vulnerability at military installations around the U.S.
They serve with valor and they serve with distinction. And when they're at their home base, they need to feel safe.
The Fort Hood case involves active duty personnel interacting with the military medical system. There is a much bigger issue for veterans, though. The VA deals with millions of claims, and since 2001 has paid more than $200 million in wrongful death claims, admissions that the VA missed something in treating post-traumatic stress disorder. Those wrongful death numbers and admissions come from a new investigation of VA treatment of combat vets by the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aaron Glantz is the staff reporter at CIR who broke this story. We'll hear from Aaron in just a moment. But we begin with Tracy Eisworth from Ocala, Florida, who yesterday, just a few hours before the tragic Fort Hood shootings, told us of her struggle for years to get her Iraq vet husband, Scott, treatment for post-traumatic stress.
He had severe PTSD. I mean, this became evident from the very time he came home. Within days, we had him at our family doctor for these very symptoms. But it wasn't just nightmares, they were night terrors. So where he would be acting out in his sleep, he would be very moody, agitated, irritated most of the time. He'd have flashbacks to where he would be like in a conversation and something would happen, like a car would backfire, just different things. And then he would be back there at the war and you'd have to kind of bring him back to where he was today, not back then. Smells bothered him. Crowds extremely bothered him. He was not the same person that had left. He came back very different.
And you experienced these flashbacks and this acting out in your own bedroom.
Yes, it had come to a point, honestly, where it was not safe to even sleep in the same bed with him, because some of these night terrors would be so violently acted out that I was actually in fear. I mean, he had hit me a few times, and not on purpose, but by accident, just by being in his sleep and acting these things out. And we had thought you just called the VA, tell them you need counseling, you need help, and it was a quick appointment. It was not that.
And what happened? What did the VA do with your symptoms and all of these details that you're telling me?
It was paperwork, and it was a process to get into the VA to get help, which we did not realize the process would take so long. So we had Scott start civilian counseling. That was the only way to get immediate help, which he needed immediately. And the VA, it was not there immediately. It was a process, and that process took time.
As Tracy Eisworth, who's describing a story and a process that was very, very difficult for her and her husband after he returned from Iraq. There's more to this story, but let's pause for a moment. Aaron Glantz, what was it that the VA was doing here by putting up this process instead of treating symptoms, which you would think a medical institution ought to be doing?
This is something that we hear so often talking with veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, where the VA has some of the best doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists in the country at treating war trauma. But then the agency has this extremely unwieldy bureaucracy that makes it very difficult for anyone to see any of these clinicians. We always hear about long wait times for necessary care. And as what we found in our investigation, that since 9/11, the VA had paid out over $200 million to nearly 1,000 veterans who died under the VA's care, and many of them died waiting for necessary treatment that could have saved their lives.
Now, Aaron, some might look at that $200 million in wrongful death claims and the 1,000 individuals that are involved here and say, okay, the system is working, the VA has a huge amount of responsibility, these are some errors that were corrected. How do you view this?
It's true, the VA sees more than 6 million veterans every year. Somebody could take a look at the 1,000 deaths that the VA paid out money in a wrongful death settlement and say, well, some degree of medical error is inevitable dealing with a system this big. The way I look at it is these are people who served their country. They went to war. They did what we told them to do. Then they got home with the expectation that the government, which sent them to war, had created a healthcare system which would take care of them and meet their needs. And it's important that we really assess how often we fail these veterans and whether or not the VA is doing enough to prevent these deaths from occurring.
Tracy Eisworth, when you look at that wrongful death number, $200 million, do you see medical error here, or do you see systematic, really a lack of sympathy for what your husband went through?
Yes, I didn't get sympathy from the VA until after Scott's suicide. I mean, initially, they failed to properly diagnose Scott's PTSD. When he finally got through this process and got in to see somebody, it was an error in their diagnosis. And then that continued with improper treatment, which they admitted their error in misdiagnosing him. They admitted his suicide was service-connected. And I got an apology and retroactive benefits that Scott would have received when he was alive. My issue is I'm not a statistic. I'm not, you know, inevitably there's going to be error. My husband's dead. And that's the bottom line. I don't like hearing, well, statistically there's going to be error. That hurts me in my heart because of what we have been through, what we continue to suffer through because he is dead.
When was the first moment that you saw the VA taking your husband's case seriously?
Well, Scott had lost his job, so we had lost his insurance. So that was how we were paying for a civilian counselor. And it wasn't until a buddy of his told him the only way to truly get in is just show up at the ER, just show up at the door and walk in. And then at the ER, at the VA, they have to see you. So that's what he did. It took him making that step before they even knew his name. So it wasn't until January of 2007 before he actually went to the VA and started the new process of getting referrals and getting doctor's appointments and all the follow-ups. But he came home November 23rd, 2005.
Aaron Glantz, is that the pattern of what your investigation shows, that the system encourages people to essentially get desperate to make their medical needs known?
We see all kinds of troubling deaths in the data. A veteran who hangs himself by his belt in a VA psychiatric ward in Seattle. A veteran who is admitted to the psych ward in Portland, Oregon, and ends up jumping off of the roof of the hospital to his death. We have 10 cases in Southern Illinois where a single doctor botched surgeries, and it's inexplicable that the VA would have hired him since he was already under investigation by the medical board in Massachusetts. So he just moved to Illinois and got a job with the federal government. We see all kinds of problems, but the thing that is so troubling is the level of denial in VA about these problems. Yes, they paid all these settlements, but they had to be dragged kicking and screaming into most of them. You know, Tracy, for example, is still fighting with the VA many years after her husband's suicide, because even though they said, we made a mistake, he had PTSD all along, you should have been getting these benefits, they have denied repeatedly the wrongful death claim that she's filed and are currently fighting it in federal court on a legal technicality.
Tracy, how long did you believe your husband was close or capable of taking his own life after he returned from Iraq?
I never seen it coming. And that was the point when I walked in to our house to find him. what really gets me is these denials for PTSD claim that he had repeatedly got was due to technicalities. I mean, it was, you didn't do this document, you didn't file it this way or whatever. So his PTSD claims, his first claim was May 2006. He killed himself May 2008. And most of that was due to technicalities. You didn't fill out the paperwork, you didn't do this right. And so whenever he received his last denial letter in May of 2008, he ripped it up. And at that moment, I did see a change in him. He gave up. He stopped going to the VA counseling. He stopped going to the VA doctors. He stopped taking the medicine. And he said, I'm done. And within a couple months, he was done. He had killed himself. I'd never seen it coming.
So, Tracy, you and Scott believed through this entire frustrating process that you were going to get through this.
Yes.
And you filled out every form, did everything they asked, and they let you down.
Yes.
That's crazy, Aaron.
The craziest part is that here we are in 2014, 6 years after Scott's death, and the VA is still fighting to avoid paying a wrongful death payment to Tracy to help her and the two children that she had with Scott survive without his income and veterans benefits. And when you think about that for a minute, and then you turn around and you look at the fact that the VA has paid out $209 million to almost 1,000 families, and you know that they really hate doing that, that they usually fight in the way that they're fighting with Tracy, it gives those numbers so much greater power and meaning. And it becomes very troubling that there isn't somebody in Washington saying, we have to stop this from happening again.
Is there anything the VA can do to end this tomorrow, Tracy?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard since Scott's death, the process has changed. It's now a phone call. I see all these 1-800 help numbers for veterans, and I truly hope that it is better, but it still doesn't replace our loss. And I don't mean to sound ungrateful for the changes that has occurred and the soldiers that are getting help, but it still doesn't replace our loss.
Tracy, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Tracy Eiswirth's husband fought with the Army National Guard in Iraq. He committed suicide after returning home, suffering from PTSD. Aaron Glantz is a staff reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The VA's response to this investigation came from spokeswoman Victoria Dillon. Quote, any adverse incident for a veteran within our care is one too many. She also noted that when a death occurs, the VA, quote, conducts a thorough review to understand what happened, prevent similar incidents in the future, and share lessons learned across the system. Early today, we asked military wife and mom and now widow Tracy Eiswirth, who you just heard from, her reaction to the news from Fort Hood. She told us, my heart goes out to the families because I have a sense of what they are going through. Unless you have been there and lived through something like this, when a soldier comes home suffering, it's a hell all of its own. To hear this news about Fort Hood, Tracy Eiswirth told us, it hurts. Some thoughts now about the situation in Iraq. As America deals with the consequences of that war in its homes and communities back home, the people of Iraq are engaged in their own imperfect healing process. Those two processes will come together in a curious and compelling moment during the upcoming Boston Marathon, when among the runners will be Lukman Faley, Iraq's ambassador to the United States. For him, running in solidarity with the victims of the Boston Marathon terrorist bombing a year ago is just part of a larger message of brotherhood and the importance of not forgetting the past, especially, Ambassador Faley says, when Americans and Iraqis have shared so much history in wartime and in fighting the scourge of terrorism together.
The key message is to show solidarity between the Iraqi and the U.S. people in relation to the fight against terrorism, that we both have suffered and we both need to work together, we need to cooperate and have a similar narrative. Terrorism will never defeat us. We will never change our discourse. We will never change our drive. That's what we want to do to achieve that.
But that is a message that one could not be very confident about in your own country right now.
On the contrary, the people have, more or less politically, terrorism has lost. It has not changed the political scene significantly. It has not changed the people's drive to prosperity, peace, and so on. On the contrary, you can see from Iraqi politics in your day in that. We have incidents, we have issues, we have crimes, which are all primarily driven by terrorism. Nobody's doubting that. But we also have clear determination of people. Let me give you a simple example. Election, peaceful election, will take place at the end of this month in Iraq. This is the fourth national election for the formation of government since 2003. So this is a sign that the people want to develop politically, want to have democracy, but we have a vicious enemy, a tumor in our society called terrorism. We have to eradicate that.
There's also, though, a narrative in your country of the splits between the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds. Where does that stand? Are these groups moving apart as we move down the road towards democracy, or are they coming together?
I would say, forgive me for using such a word, that's a binary view of it. I'm a Kurd and a Shia. I'm a Faili. That's an ethnicity in Iraq in which a significant proportion of the Kurdish and the Shia population, who are both Kurds and Shia, you can't straitjacket me into that narrative. Recently, we had a terrorist act in our own ministry, foreign ministry. 11 of my colleagues were killed. I can assure you there were Kurds, there were Arabs, there were Shia, there were Sunnis, and so on. So the terrorism we face now are not as clear-cut driven by the sectarian drive. They would like to increase the rift. They would like to divide the country to be able to have more influence. Yes, true. But that's our determination, not to straitjacket ourselves into a simple narrative of Kurds and Shias. It's not as simple as that. I wish it was.
And certainly, I don't mean to pigeonhole you, but if, as you say, the intent of the terrorists is to divide, is there trust growing between Kurds Shia and Sunni, or is the division succeeding?
There is a polarization taking place in the whole region. If you ask me, do we have enough harmony? I said no. That's what we need to achieve. We need to work more toward harmonizing our environment to move away from the sectarian narrative, more into prosperity, more into inclusion. But that's an issue across the country. That's a part of the political development, moving away from dictatorship.
As you run in Boston, there will be few, if any, signs of terrorism, except maybe right at the end of the race, where the bombing, of course, took place at the finish line. And even there, it would be nothing like doing the same race in Baghdad, where there would be signs of terrorism virtually everywhere, on every street corner. How do you keep your own personal feelings from entering into your thoughts as you run in Boston and you look around you and see the beautiful streets and the well-maintained infrastructure and know that in Baghdad, in part because of the U.S. invasion, the city is destroyed in some places? Why can't you have a beautiful city like the people of
Boston?
We
had beautiful cities. We're working toward rebuilding those cities. Other cities have developed much faster than Baghdad. I have to admit that. How do I view that? I will always, as a diplomat, have the positive outlook and say, okay, we should have that. We should work with our partners. Let me give an example. Last week, I went to Seattle to receive one of the Boeing planes. Next day, we went to Baghdad. I know next week, when we use that plane, we're providing better U.S. services to our people. That touches the people directly. They see a new plane, Boeing planes, customized to the Iraqis, with the Iraqi logo on. That's what I want to do. I want to touch the heart of the people with U.S. capabilities. There is more willingness in Iraq than I have seen in the United States. There is more psychological healthiness in Iraq than I have seen in the United States in relation to Iraq fatigueness. My participation in the marathon is another sign that you should look into Iraq as a success story in as far as your fight against terrorism is concerned, success story in your fight against trying to move into democratic processes. We had issues, but let's not haunt ourselves with that issue. Let's look forward together.
Good message. If you're running a marathon, don't give up before the finish line.
You're with a marathon mentality, which I have tried to adapt more and more, more because of my diplomatic needs for it more than anything else, with coming from Iraq, obviously. It's not an easy task to be assigned to this post after the troop withdrawal with the all last 10 years legacy, is to say, okay, you need to have that tenaciousness of the long view of things. That the mindset we need both to work together. We need to have long view.
So the night before a marathon, my carb loading is generally a big plate of pasta. What is an Iraqi ambassador load carbs the night before?
I'm getting invited by some of the students in some of the local universities over there, and I will await to see the menu. But they have suggested pasta to me. On the morning of the marathon, I will have plenty of egg, personally, boiled egg. That's my own resolution for it.
Ambassador Faley, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John. Much obliged.
Lukman Faley is Iraq's ambassador to the U.S. He'll be running in the Boston Marathon later this month. And in 2 weeks, I'll be up at our partner station WGBH in Boston reporting on the one-year anniversary of that bombing.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people. Created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
As we've told you over the past few weeks, the history of the Final Four tournament coincides with the history of television itself. Not that we need much of an excuse to have some fun with TV on the radio. But ever since we started our TV characters parallel tournament, we've been getting pushback, a headwind from you.
Are you saying birds?
You're wasting our time. The clear winner is Homer Simpson, says Ruth Smith from Denver. This is a travesty. Where's Buffy the Vampire Slayer, says Max from Brooklyn.
I cost you? That's a designer lamp, you mook.
We got calls for Perry Mason, Captain Kirk, Murphy Brown, Granny from Beverly Hillbillies, Andy of Mayberry, Miss Piggy from The Muppet Show.
Thank you, thank you.
But as we listen closely, one refrain, one notion of our omissions kept repeating, one chorus drowned out all the others.
Hawkeye Pierce was the most three-dimensional character ever to fill the airwaves, hands down.
No other TV character could make someone laugh and cry.
Cry and understand humanity by leading us to see the humor in the most unpleasant of situations.
The insights they had on war in general.
While not diminishing the horrors of war.
Who are you?
Captain Benjamin Franklin Pierce. Who are you, Sarge?
What do you think this star means?
Your Tinkerbell?
Our giant omission, not even selecting Hawkeye Pierce, played by Alan Alda in MASH, one of the most successful TV shows of all time, that omission became your opportunity. And unlike Hollywood, which often ignores angry, passionate viewers and listeners, we can't ignore you. Daniel from North Little Rock, Arkansas, says Hawkeye is a model of wit and irreverence, the unhinged anti-hero of the 4077th. Nate from Kent, Ohio, the man who eloquently and fiercely defended humor, joy, love, and the best of humanity while suffering in the hell of war and made a mean moonshine cocktail to boot.
I'd like a very dry, arid, barren, desiccated, veritable dust bowl of a martini. I want a martini that can be declared a disaster area.
You're both a disgrace to this outfit.
Oh, come on, Frank. We've all had 12 straight hours of meatball surgery in there. My brain is sending me urgent rest telegrams. You must be tired, too, after all that malpractice you put in.
You're dismissed.
Thanks, Mother. We gotta get up early anyway and fix MacArthur's hernia.
Hawkeye Pierce out of the Korean War became the voice of the Vietnam generation for sanity and anti-war, and an America that needed to rediscover itself and cling to that sense of humanity.
Dear Dad, Hawkeye here. You said I sounded a bit callous about my job in my last letter. Well, let me see if I can put it another way. We work fast and we're not dainty because a lot of these kids who can stand 2 hours on the table just can't stand 1 second more. We try to play par surgery on this course. Par is a live patient.
All right. Because of your eloquence and Hawkeye's self-evident brilliance, we open the Takeaway TV bracket to include your fave, Hawkeye Pierce. He's now officially in the running for best TV character of all time. And we reached out to someone close to Hawkeye for a reaction to your groundswell. Actor Alan Alda emailed us this. Thanks for asking me to be on the show, but I kind of think I shouldn't make an acceptance speech for something I wasn't nominated for. I do thank the many people who wanted to see the Hawkeye character included in your madness contest, but I have to say, Alan Alda told us, I'm outraged. Outraged that you completely overlooked Miss Piggy.
One knows what you want to see. You want glamour, you want pizzazz. Well, you have come to the right pig.
So the people's choice, Hawkeye Pierce, advances to the finals to join the winners of our two Final Four face-offs. And those winners, determined overnight by your votes, are Mary Richards of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, who edged out Lucy from I Love Lucy in some double-dealing manipulations that it will take a lawyer to uncover. And the even more outrageous Data of Star Trek Next Generation, our Cinderella story, who beat out Archie Bunker, which is outrageous, but probably good news for the takeaway demographic, don't you think? Go to our website to cast your vote for Hawkeye, Mary Richards, or Data. That's at thetakeaway.org. Reaction now from Texas and the communities around Fort Hood dealing with the aftermath of the shooting incident yesterday, an incident that, as President Obama noted, recalls the horror of the shooting at Fort Hood in 2009.
Obviously, this reopens the pain of what happened at Fort Hood 5 years ago. We know these families. We know their incredible service to our country and the sacrifices that they make. Obviously, our thoughts and prayers are with the entire community.
Kate McGee is covering the Fort Hood story for KUT, joining us from the newsroom in Austin, Texas. Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
So what does this stir up in the community, where things stand at Fort Hood? This is someone who really went beyond a breaking point.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, yesterday especially, there was a lot of feelings and remembrances of the 2009 shooting, mass shooting on the base when 13 people were killed and more than 30 were wounded at that point. And I think that just added to, you know, the frantic heightening and fear of many of the people who lived there trying to connect with loved ones because the base was shut down so quickly. Many people were not able to get on base. And so there were a lot of people waiting, trying to connect with their loved ones who were on base, which caused a lot of added tension and fear for not knowing what was really going on. And I think that a lot of people are wondering, you know, how did this happen twice in 5 years? And that's kind of the question that will be answered in the coming days after the shooting.
And this is something that the Texans understand very well, but they also, I suspect, can appreciate the bitter irony here. I mean, so many military facilities in Texas, and they go by, you know, the name Fort Hood, Fort This. You know, this is a language that's designed to evoke protection. This is a safe zone. This is not an area where you feel vulnerable, and yet everyone on Fort Hood yesterday and going forward feels vulnerable.
Right. And I think that that is what's raised this question that was raised at the media briefing yesterday of Army personnel on Fort Hood and other bases cannot conceal carry. And a question was posed to the general yesterday, you know, should there be changes to that policy now that we've had not one but two mass shootings in 5 years on this same base? And so I think that's the question going forward for many people. Kind of how do you prevent something like this? The general said that they'll be looking at mental health evaluations, making sure that there aren't any gaps in that, and also safety protocol and security protocol to see if there were any ways to prevent this second shooting.
Is it explicit the way in which firearms are dealt with in a place like Fort Hood, which is ultimately a concentration of weapons and of people who are experiencing the consequences of intense combat coming from Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think maybe that's one reason. There are rules about having a weapon registered on base, which this weapon apparently was not. It was bought recently off base, and they were not aware that he had purchased it, and it was not registered. And I think those are, you know, because they're dealing with people who are coming back from combat, who are dealing with high stress situations, that's why they have these rules in place to prevent and to make sure that they are, you know, knowing about, you know, what are the weapons that are on base. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of different issues to deal with in this regard with weapons on a base and dealing with the mental health aspect of you have men and women who are serving in high pressure situations and making sure you're dealing with that and also keeping those people safe on a mental health side while also being able to interact with weapons on a daily basis.
As best as you can tell, where do things emotionally stand for this community right now?
I think there is a lot of shock and definitely distress that this was happening again. You know, for people on the base and also the community of Killeen and people who are living in the area. Yesterday during the briefing at one of the hospitals, you know, they said that they were thinking a lot about the 2009 incident. Many of those doctors treated patients from 2009, were also treating patients yesterday. And so kind of seeing the similarities between the two events and it kind of stirring up emotions again, I think that's just adding to an already traumatic event of a mass shooting on base.
From the newsroom in Austin, Texas, Kate McGee is covering the Fort Hood story for KUT in Austin. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Another conversation now in a series looking at the people who come from the lands that were once under the thumb of the Soviet Union. People for whom the ghosts of a brutal 20th century history are easily stirred by the recent rhetoric and actions of Russia's leader Vladimir Putin in Crimea and Ukraine. Ilona Lalova grew up in Bulgaria. She lived there until she was 23 years old, and she remembers what it was like to live under Soviet domination until 1989, when Bulgaria, like so many other lands, set out on its own tentative road toward independence and an embrace of Europe and the West. Ilona says that in her heart, she feels that this road that has led away from Russian domination could also lead back.
I was born in the 80s, and I remember the last years of the regime. And as a kid, I studied in a Russian school. Everything was very pro-Russian. We had no Western culture or influence whatsoever. We were very limited in the information and the things we have received from any other place but Russia. And when the regime changed and the 90s came, people were very kind of excited and embraced by this possibility for things to change and go for better. But I think I lived in Bulgaria until I was 23. And through all this time, we are always having this shadow of Russia over our life in Bulgaria.
When you grew up in the 80s, were there neighbors and friends who were members of the Communist Party, part of the government?
Yeah, when the changes in the regime was about to fall, people were kind of divided into people who were supporting the regime and people who were with the Communist Party and those who were not. And even in schools, people were afraid to express openly what they think about and which side they were on because they didn't know if their neighbors or their relatives were kind of spying on them or reporting them to anyone. There was this fear in people about openly talking about their beliefs and what they want to see for their future and for their kids. So that was something definitely that was going on when I was growing up.
But there was a point at which people really began to think, you know, Russia can't touch us anymore. We're out of reach of Russia. When did that point come?
I don't think that point ever came.
Really?
I think we've always been very engaged in what's going on in Russia. There was a moment when we had kind of a very we had a government, I think, in 1997 that was democratically elected, and they did everything to, and they paved the way to Bulgaria to join the EU and NATO, and people had a ray of hope that things would change and maybe we turn to the West a little bit. But even nowadays, there are so many nationalistic parties that are trying to detach Bulgaria of where we are and turn us back to Russia. So I feel this pro-Russian sentiment has never really went away.
So being in NATO, being in the EU doesn't put Russia and Russia's influence out of reach.
It's something that cannot be extracted.
So what do you say to the argument, you know, hey, they're right next door, they're a big power, they're certainly easier to call than Barack Obama to help us out, why don't we just throw in with Russia? What happens in your gut when I say that?
I personally think this will be the worst thing that can happen. And for, I mean, I'm here now, but for everyone who is back home, to me, that will be something that will deprive them from a better future to live in a normal society where you don't have to pay the dues for being so closely tied to the Russian influence for so many years.
What's it feel like to have a country that is such a crossroads, you know, between Turkey and Europe and Russia, and, you know, all this history has really trampled over Bulgaria for hundreds and hundreds of years?
Yeah, we're definitely in the middle of so many tumult zones, and we want to be in a region that's stable. I mean, it's definitely a threat, what's going on and what happened in Crimea, because it's setting a precedent, and if that can easily continue if there is no repercussion to what Putin has done.
What should be the repercussion?
I mean, he should not be allowed to do whatever he wants and not face any consequences, because that's a threat to the whole region and to Europe as well. Maybe the Western powers should be more enforceful in stepping down and not allowing him to, sanctioning him in some way, so he cannot proceed with bullying everyone in his region.
But you see, stop it now, or else there are going to be consequences.
I would like to see that. I would like him to be kind of not allowed to proceed with what he had started.
Can you see a Maidan Square protest movement in Bulgaria like we saw in Kiev?
I mean, we had a protest last year when we had parliamentarian elections, when the government, the newly formed government, appointed somebody who was clearly linked to the mafia to be the chief of the national security unit. So young people went on the streets, and there were protests here as well and everywhere in the world. It became a really great movement, and it went for a long time. It was something also reminiscent of the 90s when people went on the streets and they were very enthusiastic about facing a new form of government coming up in Bulgaria, in the way of Bulgaria's new politics. But unlike in Ukraine, the thing that's happening in Bulgaria kind of dwindled down, and now it's becoming more focused on specific concerns that are might be ecological or for different projects that the government is trying to push forward, or reforms that people don't agree with.
If the government tomorrow said, all right, we're going to have a referendum, do you want to go with Russia or do you want to go with
Never.
The West? How would that referendum come out? Would it be a close one?
I would like to say no, but honestly, I would not be surprised if it is.
If they would vote to go with Russia?
I mean, I think we're far from there, but it's definitely something that's scary and can be a potential scare for us.
Ilona, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ilona Lalova grew up in Bulgaria, moved to New York in 2005 when she was 23 years old. Coming up next, the people's voice in elections. Does it compete with money from wealthy campaign contributors, or is money just a part of the political speech? Regulate money or let it speak. From Austin, Texas, get money out of elections. This is a clear case of the wealthy being able to buy elections and put in candidates who will follow the status quo. Or Orange City, Florida, money is just another form of speech and shouldn't be limited. Incumbents already have huge advantages. Campaign finance limits advantage incumbents more. Does money simply talk in politics, or does it corrupt democracy? A discussion of the Supreme Court decision McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission coming up next. We'd love to know what you think. 8778-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com.
There were a couple of lines that stood out from yesterday's landmark Supreme Court decision, the 5-4 striking down of limits on what are called aggregate campaign contributions. A couple of lines that stand out and frame a giant debate on the impact of money in a democracy. First, Chief Justice Roberts writes in the majority opinion that contributing to a campaign is no different than carrying a sign with a political message written on it. The government may no more restrict how many candidates or causes a donor may support than it may tell a newspaper how many candidates it may endorse. And here's the dissent from Justice Stephen Breyer, who says money inherently corrupts the political process and unlimited money makes matters worse. Quote, corruption breaks the constitutionally necessary chain of communication between the people and their representatives. Where enough money calls the tune, the general public will not be heard. From the majority and the dissent in yesterday's Supreme Court decision, McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission. Reaction from Capitol Hill? Well, here's House Speaker John Boehner.
Freedom of speech is being upheld. You all have the freedom to write what you want to write. Donors ought to have the freedom to give what they want to give.
And here's the dissent from Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island.
The discussion of corruption and how it works in elections is amateurish and naive to an extreme that boggles the mind. And it really makes me wonder whether they've thought this through.
Let's continue this debate over freedom of speech versus a notion of money and corruption in the political process. Jamie Raskin joins us, professor of constitutional law at American University. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Also with us is Paul Sherman, senior attorney at the Institute of Justice. Paul, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So, Jamie Raskin, take the Roberts argument first. What do you think of this idea that restricting campaign donors is like restricting the editorial page of newspapers?
Well, it cuts against everything that our federal campaign finance laws have stood for the last several decades. And this decision constitutes a virtual wipeout of what's left of our federal campaign finance laws. Essentially, this applies to a tiny percent of the population, less than 1% of 1% who give at that level. You know, they were allowed to give up to $123,000, essentially, if you add all the different aggregate limits together. And now they're going to be able to give millions of dollars directly to candidates. So there's very little left of the campaign finance regime. And I think that Justice Breyer is making the point that the vast majority of the public feels at this moment, which is, well, what is the role for the public in a campaign finance regime that's increasingly dominated and dictated by the wealthiest people in the country and by large corporations?
That's Jamie Raskin, professor of constitutional law at American University and a state senator representing Montgomery County in Maryland. All right, attorney Paul Sherman, take on Justice Breyer's argument. Does money drown out the voice of the public and thereby have an effect on speech in the form of corruption?
No, and I think one of the most important things about Chief Justice Roberts' response to Justice Breyer is that it takes seriously evidence in First Amendment cases. One thing that not a lot of people know is that the overwhelming majority of American states do not have aggregate contribution limits like the federal aggregate limit. But there is not a shred of evidence that was presented in this case, or even that was not presented in the case, finding that those states are either more corrupt or less well-governed than states that do have such limits. And what Roberts is really saying when he responds to Breyer is, we can't just rely on hypotheticals, on things that might be possible because they don't defy the laws of physics. We have to look at what happens in the real world. And in the real world, there's no evidence that our 40 years of campaign finance restrictions have done anything to actually reduce corruption or the appearance of corruption in politics.
All right, Paul, let me just focus on that a little bit, because Justice Roberts seems to narrowly define corruption as a quid pro quo operation where somebody gave a campaign contribution and then gets something in return, a golf course in Las Vegas. Is that a too narrow argument and really doesn't address Justice Breyer's notion that you can weigh in with $6 million the day before Election Day and have an impact on the election?
Well, I don't think it is too narrow, and I would have two responses. The first is that in terms of having an impact on the election, we have to look at what stands between that contribution and the impact on the election, and that's voters. Ultimately, no matter how much people are giving to campaigns, it's up to voters to decide if the messages that they're hearing are persuasive and compelling. And if they don't, then those candidates who are receiving those contributions aren't going to be elected. Now, as to whether we need to have a broader definition of corruption, I don't think so. And I think what we're seeing with Justice Breyer's dissent is an interpretation of corruption that would swallow the rule established in the First Amendment that we protect the individual's right to decide for themselves how much they want to participate in the political process.
Jamie Raskin, a rebuttal?
Well, let's see. On that definition of corruption, the one that Chief Justice Roberts is pushing, and I think Paul's agreeing with, it's hard to see why there should be any campaign finance laws other than laws against bribery. And even laws against bribery, by the way, I think would be suspect under their definition. After all, if money is just speech and giving money is just an act of political association and expression, why shouldn't I be able to give $5,000 or indeed $1 million directly to a politician to express how strongly I feel about a particular issue?
Can I put that directly to Paul Sherman? So if money equals speech, Paul Sherman, bribery is legal.
No, that's absolutely not the case. And I think there's a fundamental distinction between money that is being given to a candidate for the candidate to use for the purpose of promoting his views to the public and money that is being given to the candidate so that the candidate can buy a lake house. The former implicates the First Amendment strongly. The latter does not. And there's no problem with the government prohibiting the latter.
Jamie Raskin, final point.
Well, I thought that their argument was that if I give money directly to a candidate, I'm expressing my own political views. So what they do with it should be irrelevant. In any event, there's very little of campaign finance law left. And I think for people who do believe in what Justice Breyer is talking about, which is representative democracy, where politicians are not beholden to donors, but are beholden to people and should be governed by reason and communication rather than money, we have to figure out a way to rebuild a meaningful system of political equality in terms of the campaign finance regime.
Jamie Raskin, professor of constitutional law at American University, also state senator representing Montgomery County in Maryland. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Paul Sherman, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Sherman is senior attorney at the Institution of Justice in Washington, D.C.
Hi, this is Andrew from Portland, Oregon. I'm continually dismayed by the Supreme Court and their decisions regarding money and politics. I think that corporate donations are corroding the very base of elections and putting unjust pressure on the system. And I wish that we could return to more of a system of public finance for all of our elections for a safer and healthier democracy.
Hi, my name is Barry Wynn, and I'm calling from Brighton, Michigan. I think your question about what role money should play in elections is largely irrelevant. We need to figure out how to prevent further disenfranchisement of voters in spite of money. Money is not going anywhere.
That's an interesting idea. So if more people voted, it would beat out money in the competition between money and the people's voice. Love that. You know how to reach us, 877-8 My Take from Norfolk, Virginia. The need for campaign money is what prevents a lot of good people from running for office. It basically creates an oligarchy where we are supposed to have a democracy. New York City. Money should play no role in elections. Elections should be for the people, by the people, not for the people with money. And from Riverside, California, whatever 10% of the national median household annual income is should be the max an individual can give annually in total to any political campaign. That will level the playing field. We'd love to know your idea. We'd love for you to vote. Voice of the people. Best TV character of all time. Go to thetakeaway.org. It's between Hawkeye Data or Mary Richards. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.